accession number 7498 Real 3.
Major Horridge, Real 3. You were telling me about your evening inspections in White Trench.
Yes, well, quite unfortunately, we had, when you were on duty, to visit the sentries, and you had to walk down the trench. And as all the men were lying in the bottom of the trench, it's practically impossible in the dark to avoid treading on them at times. And I can assure you that when you trod on some of these chaps, the language you heard bored very much on the vulgar, shall we say, or even you learnt a lot of words you never heard of before, especially if you happened to tread on his face. But this couldn't be avoided, isn't it? Oh, there it was.
So they just lay in the trenches. Did they lie on the fire step or actually on the very bottom?
There wasn't a fire step in this particular trench, I don't think, because it wasn't a front line trench. It never had been.
Could you describe the dugout you had with the corporal?
Yeah, just a square, a rectangular hole, about 3 feet deep and about 7 feet long by about 3 feet wide, 3 or 4 feet wide.
Did you have any sort of...
We slept in there, yeah.
Did you have any sort of personal possessions in there? Did you leave all your...
I've forgotten. Yes, I must have had something, blankets or something like that. Everybody was given a blanket, you know.
Where did you get your rations from?
Where?
And what did they consist of?
Well, the rations were drawn from the battalion quartermaster stores, which in this particular case were situated Krithianulla was not a big stream at that particular time of the year. There was a certain amount of water ran down, but it wasn't a very big stream. And the battalion quarters were situated on the banks of Krithianulla, and the rations came from there. It consisted of breakfast. You've got some bacon, you've got tea. Of course, you had mess tins, which you ate out of, you see. Tea and 3 dog biscuits with Pratt's name on them, some butter, and I think it was about 8 to a pot of jam, and some cheese, and a tin of bully beef.
Was this adequate?
Well, it was adequate to keep you healthy, but it wasn't as much as you'd like to have had, by any means.
Well, where did you get your water from?
The water was all... it had to be treated. I've forgotten exactly what you call it, but it's treated like some town's water is treated.
Did this leave...
And it was all brought, I suppose, in big containers from the ships.
Did it taste of anything in particular?
Yeah, it tasted of... Well, I just can't describe it. It's like you get in some towns where they have to treat the water. Same sort of thing.
Did you have any problem with flies?
Yes, but not at this particular time. The fly didn't appear till after the Third Battle of Krithia on the 4th of June. And I was wounded on that particular date and didn't get back till 5 weeks later. By that time, the flies were then, I should say, in full strength.
What about sanitary arrangements? Were the latrines...
Latrines were dug behind the trenches, in the open. And, of course, there was a spade shovel that could shovel dirt in.
What was the climate like?
Oh, the climate was hot in the daytime. And when we first landed on Gallipoli, it was cold at night. Gradually that changed, and I think in about another two weeks or so it got very reasonably warm at night, very hot in the daytime.
Did you have any other, besides the duties you've already described as an officer, second lieutenant, did you have any other special duties during this period in the trenches?
Yes, we had to get food from the ships, where they were unloading the ships. In other words, fatigue is what I'm trying to think about. We were on fatigue duties. We were sent down to the ships and unloading and carrying them where we were told to do. And also there was trench digging to be done and so on. And I remember my second in command of my company said to me when I was going down to the beach to unload something, he said, "Now, if your entrenching tool happens to fall on a box and happens to open it," he said, "you might bring something back." So we went down to the beach and were unloading wooden boxes. Strangely enough, my entrenching tool fell on the box and it opened. And you know what was inside it? Pickles. Which weren't much good to us, I'm afraid. That was land digging trenches, of course, mule tracks. There were two mule tracks. They had to be dug. And there was, of course, a lot of work. You didn't get any leisure time.
Were you detailed as an officer, or was your platoon detailed for these, for such things?
No, we were, the officers were detailed to take them at certain men to do the job. Or if there weren't any officers available, the NCO did it.
You weren't actually under fire except from spent bullets?
No, not in this particular, not until June the 4th.
How was the men's health then during this period? Did it start to
deteriorate? Oh, our men's health was quite good until June the 4th, till the flies came.
You were, for a time, in the 2nd Australian line.
Yes.
Could you describe what happened there?
Yeah, we were only there for a very short time. I have no real knowledge of why we were there, because the battalion as a whole was still in the White Line. But our company was sent into the 2nd Australian Line, which was, I suppose, about 300 yards in front of us. Must have been to be in a support line. Perhaps it was thought to be necessary for somebody to be there. And this was about the middle of May, and one day it started to rain, and it rained tremendously hard. The trench got full of water, and we got wet through, of course. And then it stopped raining, sun came out, and we took off what we could dare take off to dry, put it on the back of the trench, got it pretty dry, put it on again, and sure enough it came on to rain again. And it rained so hard that the parados and the parapet of the trench were broken down in one place and a river flowed through the trench. And then we were relieved that night, and one of my platoon, who I think was more than 17, he wasn't able to carry his wet blanket down, and I carried it for him, and he's still alive today, and is about the only other soldier to go on the Gallipoli ceremonial parade, bury in the parish church in memorial of the landing of the 1st Battalion on W Beach.
Was the White Line a support trench as well?
Yes, I think you could term it a support line, but there was a trench dug right across the peninsula which was supposed to be a line used as a sort of final stand if the enemy should break through the front line at any time. And this line was built not under fire at all, but under the instruction of the Royal Engineers, and it was perfectly shaped traverses which were actually the correct angles and everything, and it ran right across the peninsula, and it was called the Esky Line. I have an idea that Esky in Turkish means old, but I don't quite see what that's called. I don't know why it was called the Esky Line, but that's what it was called, and that was the sort of main line of defence if the front broke down.
Throughout this period, did you have any contacts with the United Kingdom, with the, letters?
Oh, yes. The communications between United Kingdom and ourselves were very good. I got letters regularly. In fact, it may sound strange, but I used to get a parcel every week from home consisting of a shirt, a pair of drawers, and a vest, clean, a piece of paper and some string, a packet of tobacco, and I used to change my underclothes, send them back to be washed at home, and I avoided the vermin that everybody else was getting. Of course, everybody was getting body lice, but I never got body lice because of this method of transport with home.
So basically you sent your laundrette home to be done by your mother.
Yes, and it's amused a lot of people since I tell them I sent my washing home from Gallipoli. But that's what I did.
Yeah, but no other officers did this.
Never heard of anybody else, except my brother. He might have done it. No, you couldn't get the lice away. You could go and bathe in the sea, and you could take your clothes with you and your shirt and things, but you couldn't get rid of them. And of course it was a general, what called sort of parade in the morning, and everybody had their shirts off and nipping these lice between their thumbnails and things like that. This was a regular occurrence. Couldn't get rid of them. Because, of course, the blankets got infested, and when you moved, the blankets weren't given to the same chap every time. They had to be collected and put in bundles. Then they were dished out again. And gradually blankets got infested with them. Everybody did. But of course I had my own sleeping bag. I didn't have to have a blanket. I had my own sleeping bag.
How did military discipline operate at the time? Did you have to come down hard on people? Was there any incidents of people falling asleep on duty?
You're now talking about when we're in the front lines, are you?
Well, no, in the White Trench.
Nothing happened there. It's happened in the front lines, of course, but not there.
What sort of recreational things did you do? Were there any games played?
Nothing, no.
Cards? Or?
No, I don't think so. Nothing, I don't think of that. They were too busy. We were on fatigue all day, and we weren't sleeping all night because of having to be on duty. There was no time for anything else. There was one place in Gallipoli which you could see if you go up Gully Ravine, where there was a level patch of ground where I think people did kick football about. It was out of view of the Turks, and you can still go to this place and see it, and it's fairly level, and I think they used to use that as a sort of football ground, but I personally never played on it, because that particular part, Gully Ravine, was in the sector of the 29th Division. It wasn't in our 42nd Division sector until the 29th Division left for Suvla Bay, and then we took over the left sector.
Could you tell me, I believe that you once went down to try and get extra stores from your quartermaster sergeant. Could you tell me that story?
Yeah, I'll tell you the story. Because for young people, like myself, the amount of rations we got weren't enough to drive hunger away from the door. And we began to get very hungry. The flies hadn't come then, and we were perfectly well in health. And so I said to this lad I was living with in this dugout, I said, you know, I think I'll go down to the quartermaster and see if I can't get something a bit extra out of him. I've been told that he was very keen on cricket and used to go down to Old Trafford, lots of county cricket matches, and he'd been slightly wounded by a nose of a shell cap, and I think he liked to be asked about this. Anyhow, I set off and I went down, and I had a better, perhaps not better mentioned names. I said, How are you going on? How was your wound? Oh, he said, it's improving all right, thank you. I said, you know, it's different here, isn't it, to going down to cricket matches at Old Trafford? He said, yeah, come and sit down for a minute, Horridge. So I sat down and we talked for quite a bit. And then I said, you know, do you think it's possible that we could get a bit of extra something to eat? But I was terribly hungry. He said, oh, are you hungry? No, I said, yeah, we are hungry. Oh, well, I tell you what we'll do. You come down tonight about 1 o'clock in the morning with a sandbag, and we'll get the quartermaster sergeant to put something in it for you. Then he called the quartermaster sergeant to him, and he said, I've told Mr. Horridge to come down. To come round at 1 o'clock with a sandbag, you'll put a little bit of extra ration in for him. Oh, I said, yes, that's very nice. Thanks very much. Thanks very much. So I then went back to the dugout, and Cecil Clark, and I said, Meredith, we're in, and all that, and waited for 1 o'clock in the evening to come. And at 7 o'clock, the company commander called a conference and said, the next day we were going to go into a battle on the 4th of June, called the Third Battle of Krithia, and we were going to attack Krithia again. So we moved out, up to the front line, and I must have been very dense, because I didn't realise, of course, that the joke was played on me by a quartermaster, who knew perfectly well I couldn't be able to come at 1 o'clock in the evening. I didn't get the extra ration. I got wounded next day instead.
Could you tell me what you were told your role would be in this upcoming battle that was to be the Third Battle of Krithia?
Yes. The as far as our division was concerned, the Manchester Brigade were to attack over the top in two lines. First wave was to start at 12 o'clock, and the second wave is to go, I think, at 12:15, leapfrog the first wave. We're supposed to have taken the first trench, and they were supposed to take the second trench, and then proceed from there according to how the circumstances were. If they thought they could go further, they must go on. Now, two of the companies of my battalion were transferred for this operation to the 6th Manchester Regiment. And the other two companies, of which I were one, our duty was to hold the frontline trench that the 8th Manchesters went out of.
Where was this frontline trench?
Well, if anybody knows Gallipoli, it was to the right of the Krithia nullah, and it was opposite, just about opposite, where now is Redoubt Cemetery. I think Redoubt Cemetery now has a road running past it with large fir trees and goes down to Krithia nullah. And if you were to go into a wood, which is about 150 yards in front of Redoubt Cemetery, you'll see the outline aware what was once a trench, and I think that was the front line trench on June the 4th, before the battle of June the 4th, the Third Battle of Krithia started.
But your role was to guard the front trench from which the attacking battalions went?
Yes.
Well, can you tell me how you moved up to the front line?
Well, we moved up by night, of course. And we didn't get into the frontline trench that night. We lay down somewhere on the way. And I remember I slept with my head on a stone. And the other troops passed us. And I remember me seeing one or two chaps I knew, other battalions. But it's very, very shadowy my memory as to actually that night. Eventually we got into this trench I've been telling you about.
Well, were you under artillery fire? In fact, were you under artillery fire at all during this whole period leading up to June the 4th?
No, I don't think we were. Nothing to speak of, anyhow. I don't say a few shells didn't drop, but not what you call really under artillery fire.
So, could you take me through the events of June the 4th as you saw them?
Yes, well, we got into the trench with the 8th Manchesters, and there'd been some preliminary bombardment of the trench's line, but it really, the bombardment, which really was for the battle, didn't commence till 12 o'clock noon. And this proceeded for 25 minutes. I beg your pardon, I made a mistake. At 11 o'clock it started. Proceeded for 25 minutes. And then the bombardment ceased. And the troops in the front line were supposed to wave their bayonets over the top and a shout as though they were going to attack so as to bring the Turks, who got under cover of the artillery bombardment, would man the trenches again and would be then when the bombardment commenced again. So there was 5 minutes lapse, and then at 11:30 the bombardment started again. Well, the part of the line that I was in, the Turkish trench, I don't think would be more than 130 to 140 yards in front. And I believe, I'm not sure, that behind us was the French 75 field guns, which are very, very accurate. And they were the ones that were firing over our heads. And from the whizzing of the noise of the shells, it sounded as though they weren't more than about 3 or 4 feet above your head. And we, of course, were keeping down in the trench. And I looked over the trench once or twice, and they were certainly, they were hitting the trench all right. And things were going up in the air and that sort of thing, and they were hitting the trench all right. But of course we were always a bit scared that something short had happened and one of these shells had come in our trench. But as I say, they were accurate and this didn't occur. And at 12 o'clock, the Manchesters attacked and went over the top. And eventually, before long, disappeared into the Turkish frontline trench. After that, we don't know, we didn't know on the day what happened to them because they disappeared out of sight behind this first trench. They couldn't see beyond that. And then about 12:10, after about 10 minutes, of course, everybody had started firing by this time. The Turks' artillery were firing, their machine guns were firing, the riflemen were firing, everybody were firing. Our people were firing as well. I looked over the top and saw one of these Manchester fellas, evidently wounded, lying on his tummy, about 30 yards in front of the trench, holding up his hand. Well, although I rather hesitate to tell this tale, because it may sound as though I'm saying something in favour of myself, which I really wasn't, but to tell the true story, what came into my mind was this. You wondered, before ever you got into action, I suppose nearly every soldier must have wondered, what he would feel like, what would happen when he actually got there with the metal flying about all over the place. And I thought about it too. I wondered what would happen when the time came to go over the top or something like that. And as I saw this chap, it struck me that this was the moment I'd been waiting for. What was I going to do? Here was the moment. You wondered what you would do. And if you don't go now and do something, you'll remember all your life that you didn't, you failed at that moment. Nobody else will know you failed, but you will know you failed. And so in a way, I was forced by those feelings to try and get this chap in. I went to another of my platoon called Parks, who was on sentry duty in the trench. I said, look, Parks, let's go out and see if we can get this chap in. Sparks jumped out of the trench. I followed him. I hadn't gone more than about 6 yards before I felt that I'd be hit by a sledgehammer in the ribs, and I knew then that I'd been hit. Well, as I said, this sound may sound rather blowing one's own trumpet, but as soon as I was hit, I say that all idea of bringing the Manchester man in disappeared. All I was concerned about was getting back into the trench. So I turned around, ran and jumped into the trench, it was about 7 feet deep, sprained my ankle, which lasted longer than the wound had gone, and there I was, wounded. Parks brought the Manchester chap in, but I'm sorry to say he died during that afternoon. So then my wound was dressed up, and I lay on the parapet, well, just wondering what was going to happen, what was happening in the attack. We didn't know what was happening in the attack. We didn't know whether the Turks were going to counterattack, whether they'd come back and take our trench. We didn't know anything. And about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the company commander sent word to me and said I must go down to the hospital. So I then, with the assistance of one or two stretcher bearers, there were no stretchers left, they'd gone, but one or two medical fellows helped me down to the nearest dressing station. And that was really the end for me of the Third Battle of Ypres. Third Battle of Krithira, I really meant, of course.
I'd like to take a few items of detail from that account and see if we get a little more information. When you looked over the top during the artillery barrage from the French 75s, what exactly could you see?
Well, we could see the shell hitting the trench. Of course, 75s were the equivalent of our 18-pounders. We could see the shells hitting the trench and bursting and blowing up such things like woodwork or something. We didn't know what it was. But under the circumstances, of course, you didn't feel like looking over the trench very long. And I think when he looked over for about 5 seconds, you got down again. And that's all that I saw once or twice that I looked over the top.
Did the Turks have any barbed wire out?
Oh, yes, the Turks had barbed wire out, yeah.
Had there been...
I think that had been damaged by the artillery because the Manchester's got through.
When you were making... Did you actually make this demonstration you were supposed to and wave your bayonets and shout?
The men did, yes.
You took part in that, did you?
Oh, yes. People in our trench all did. Everybody had to do it. It was an order. Oh, yes.
What did you think of this as an idea?
Well, we could realise a sense of it, because, of course, the Turks were getting as much undercover as possible. And so if you bring them out again, thinking the attack had started, you're going to get a lot more casualties, and the trenches aren't going to be full of people when you get there.
When you looked out from the trench and saw the wounded Manchester chap, what else could you see? Did you see anything of the Manchester's actual attack?
No, they'd gone past the front line by that time. The Turkish front line, of course. Or they were in the Turkish front line. There were none of the people left walking across or doubling across. There were none of those left. They'd gone into the next trench. They were invisible. There was only an odd one or two had been hit on the way.
Did you actually see the Manchester's attack then?
Oh, yes. I watched them go across top. Yeah.
And how did
they disappeared into the front line trench, and that was that. Then we lost sight of them.